You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Compaq Computers was launched in a Houston diner in 1981 by three friends who set out to build a portable PC that would take on IBM, the world's most powerful tech company at the time. And they became a Fortune 500 company in the space of just 3 years. In his new documentary film, Silicon Cowboys, Jason Cohn explores this remarkable David versus Goliath story and how Compaq, an unlikely upstart, altered the future of computing and helped shape the world as we know it. It opens this Friday at the Village East Cinema and is also available on demand. I'm very happy that it brings director Jason Cohn and Rod Canyon, one of those founders of Compaq Computers, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Jason, what distinguished the story of Compaq Computers from the rest of the tech companies of the time?
Well, you know, they were revolutionary. That was a bit of what drew me to the story when it was first brought to me in Rod's book and the producers who came to me with this story. And it was a story I didn't know. I knew a little bit about, but it was a story that I felt like people didn't really know. You know, especially in these last few years, obviously we hear a lot about Steve Jobs and Zuckerberg and Gates and people like that. And this was a story of a company that, they had an impact on us, and I think a lot of us don't know it. And not only that, there was a great narrative about how they went about doing it and making a mark.
Rod, where did you meet your fellow co-founders, Jim Harris and Bill Murdaugh?
The three of us had worked together for 5 to 10 years at Texas Instruments. And even more important than that, we had worked together on starting up a business in TI. And in that process, we had ventured out to Silicon Valley to meet with some companies who were startups. And I have to say that the bug was planted in that process that just never would go away.
So you learned entrepreneurship within a company.
Exactly.
All three of you quit Texas Instruments without having another job lined up.
Yes, it was. Most people don't even believe that, but you know, that wasn't our original plan. But in the fall of 1981, we went to Comdex in Las Vegas, and the excitement was just so unbelievable. We came back to Houston and just said, we can't wait anymore. We're going to get going.
Did you have a kind of a company in mind? Were you doing something similar to Texas Instruments?
No. In fact, because TI was very protective of their technology, we knew we couldn't do anything that would be competitive with them. And we also knew we couldn't invent anything that would be competitive while we were there. So we had actually come together on a business plan that we knew was a very weak idea, but it was something to get going, to meet people and to get into the flow. And right after we quit, the people we had talked to about funding that immediately said, no, we're not going to fund that. And that put us back on, let's start over and figure out something better.
And you mentioned you went to Silicon Valley. It wasn't called Silicon Valley then.
Well, we called it Silicon Valley, but not many people did. They just didn't know where it was.
Jason, during the 60s and 70s, what type of computing system was IBM involved with?
Well, you know, IBM was the computer industry in the 60s and 70s, and that was mainframe computers. And all the government contracts went to IBM, and they really ruled the whole industry. There really wasn't anyone that would even be considered a competitor. It was IBM, and you know, we found archival footage of old government films, you know, where they bringing out some of the IBM former executives and things like that. And it really was a situation where when you thought of computers, it was Big Blue.
Had they gotten involved with personal computing?
No. So we highlight that in the story. In 1981, August of 1981, they introduced the IBM PC, and as we say in the film, and Rod says that just caused that market to explode, and it changed the landscape. And you had a lot of people lining up to try to mimic what they were doing.
What was the first personal computer you owned, Rod?
It was an Apple II. I bought it for me, and my oldest son learned how to program on it and went on to have a career there.
So at the time that you were creating Compaq, Apple was already around. Microsoft had been around even a little longer. What were they doing?
Well, they were starting the PC industry. I mean, it was up and going, and companies like Apple, who was one of the leaders, thought IBM did not understand the industry at all. So they weren't worried when IBM entered the market. That was a mistake.
But your idea was not just to do a PC, but to do something that was portable?
Well, we didn't want to be where IBM was. We did not want to compete with IBM. That would have been foolish. So we looked around.
And you couldn't compete with Texas Instruments, you said.
That's right.
Those are the two biggies at the time.
That's right. But what we looked around and said, there is no real significant portable market yet. But if we can build a portable, it'll run the same software as the IBM PC. Now, that would really be a good product. So we started out down that path.
And you had problems getting funding initially? People think it was a stupid idea?
It actually came pretty fast. The whole question was, could we actually make this portable run IBM software? That was the trick, and that was the really hard part. But once we presented the idea to Seven Rosen, a fairly new venture capital firm, they checked us out, and then they sent us out to the West Coast. We had to talk to Kleiner Perkins, and within about a month of the idea coming to me, we had funding.
Now, would it have been easier to set this up in Silicon Valley?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
But you did it in Texas.
Well, we had deep roots there. We had our families there. We had small children. And so we might have moved if we had to, but we didn't have to, it turned out.
But Texas is, Silicon Valley was where the pool of tech experts was. You had to convince people to quit their jobs and join you in the middle of Texas.
Well, we did, but they wouldn't do that actually in the beginning. So the first place we drew from was Texas Instruments, and that led to a lawsuit from TI, and that was eventually settled. But
they said you were raiding their employees.
Well, that's not illegal in Texas. So they said we had stole secrets, which they didn't really know what we were doing. They just did the lawsuit, I think, to try to slow us down because we had hired about 10 people, I think.
And Compaq then became the first company to legally reverse engineer the IBM personal computer. Can you discuss the idea behind compatibility in building a product?
Well, to us, it was really simple. We had this idea for a great product, except the way the industry was working, there were too many new companies, and you couldn't get software developers to adapt their software to your product. So the simple idea of, well, if we can make it run somebody else's software, then maybe we have a product. And IBM was the perfect example because they had all the software and they were the easiest to reverse engineer.
Wasn't their code copyrighted?
Yes, it was. So it was, as one guy used the example of, it was kind of like playing baseball blindfolded. You had to figure out how it did it without looking at anything that they actually did.
And you still were able to get around the copyrights?
We were. It took us a long time, and it was the only way we ever were able to do it was through brute force. We had to get a lot of people banging on software, finding out what didn't work, why it didn't work, and then fixing that. And over about a 9-month period, we were able to get ours to work.
So you were inventing an IBM computer system.
Well, we were inventing a much different system that ran the same software. That's quite a bit different.
My guests are Rod Kenyon, one of the founders of Compaq Computer, and Jason Cohn, who's made a film called Silicon Cowboys that is opening this Friday at the Village East Cinema. When it comes to technology, Jason, there's so much that we take for granted these days. I'm sure many people can't recall how things were before cell phones or laptops were around. As a filmmaker, what do you do to give the viewer a feel of what the world was like in 1982 when it came to technology?
Well, one of the fun things about making this film was the treasure trove of archival footage that we had to play around with. And I was given just boxes and boxes of Betamax tapes from the 80s, from Compaq's early days, of old marketing videos and commercials and news clips and things like that. So it was a lot to go through, hundreds of hours of footage, but there were some real gems in there. And when you see the first portable, which was a 28-pound luggable that more resembled a sewing machine with a handle on it than it did a computer, it's striking. And I think people, we've been screening the film a little bit at festivals and some advanced screenings around the country, and I think people are blown away by what it was. And this caught on, and we have the shots of the people walking through airports with these computers and how people were just in awe of seeing a mobile computer for the first time on a mass scale.
And then things got more and more miniaturized, which made it a little easier?
Well, it took the technology advancing a lot over the next decade to get it really down. In fact, throughout the 80s, the only really complete computer you could build was about the size of the product we were building. They weren't the laptops at all. But late in the 80s, miniaturization finally got there, and we began to build notebooks and laptops.
It's been pointed out that HAL in the movie 2001, which is huge, today would be the size of a cell phone, maybe even smaller.
Yeah, well, we pointed out just last week with the release of the new iPhone, and we did a little thing where we compared it to the first portable, and the first portable they put out had 720 kilobytes of storage, and the new iPhone came out, and you can get up to 256 gigabytes of storage, and not to mention the weight, 28 pounds versus 4 ounces.
That's about a million times.
Wow! Can you tell us about the compact wrap video?
Well, as I mentioned, there was a treasure trove of videos, which included some internal videos that the company had done over the years, and they had a guy who was a little bit out of the box in his thinking, and he got the people to do some stuff that maybe they weren't totally comfortable with. And one of the things they did was when they made $1 billion, when they had sold $1 billion, they made a video called the Compact Wrap, and it was a spoof of the Chicago Bears Super Bowl Shuffle of 1985, set to the same sort of tune. And it was all these buttoned-up executives, including Rod, in a boardroom, rapping to this song they made up with these lyrics. And they had some of the old computers, and you had a guy sitting on a desk. And we knew that was going in the film. When I came across it when I was going through my research, and the first thing I did was upload it and send it to the producers just to tell them, look what I just found. And we knew that was going in the film. I wish there was a lot more I wish we could have used, but we did get a clip of it in there.
Let me just say, that was never intended to be in a movie. That was for internal use only. But, after so much time, so what?
It's fun.
Yeah, it is.
Now, in 1982, when you were coming out with this product, was IBM the personal computer leader, or had Apple and Microsoft already made inroads?
IBM became the leader of the market in an incredibly short time. In fact,
well, they had a head start.
Well, they knew a lot about computers, but they knew nothing about microcomputers. At least that's what Apple thought. Apple actually took out a half-page ad in the Wall Street Journal welcoming IBM to the PC industry. Mm-hmm. And a year later, IBM had passed them and was the leader. And it's a classic case of the guys that started the industry not really realizing the power of a brand like IBM's. So they just came in and took over. So they were the 500-pound gorilla for sure.
Are you surprised by how poorly IBM has fared since?
Well, that's a long story. I mean, they had sort of a house of cards with their mainframes because the technology was advancing in the microprocessor area. But they were still a very powerful company, and their brand was strong, and they built good products. They made a couple of mistakes, not really understanding the importance of this industry standard compatibility that was what Compact did.
How did they view their competitors?
Well, according to the people we found from IBM that were in the film, not very well. I mean, they didn't think anybody could really touch IBM. So they, one of the great things about the movie, Jason interviewed this man, Bill Ouellette from IBM, who had actually been in the marketing of PCs during the 80s. And so he could tell you what they were thinking. When the portable came out, for example, he says it was nothing. It was just a ripple of anything. When we had our first year sales of $111 million, the biggest ever of any company, they said, well, there was a little bit of a ripple, but so what, And then on and on. Finally, his last phrase I love is, maybe this is bigger than we thought.
Yeah, just to put that in context, he says it was a blip on the screen, and it was at the time. They sold a little over 50,000 portables their first year. In that same year, IBM had sold 750,000 PCs. So they were not looking at these guys as potentially somebody who could knock them off their throne.
My guests are Jason Cohn, filmmaker, his latest Silicon Cowboys, which opens this Friday at the Village East Cinema and also will be available on demand, and Rod Canyon, C-A-N-I-O-N, who is one of the three founders of Compact Computers, did it in a diner. It's kind of like that movie Diner. Three guys get together and they change things. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with filmmaker Jason Cohn and Rod Canyon, one of the founders of Compact Computers, subject of a film called Silicon Cowboys that opens this Friday at the Village East Cinema and will also be available on demand. How, Rod, you mentioned it took a while to get the Compact computer going. How long was it in development before it was finally unveiled in 1982?
It was about 9 months. We started in the middle of February and announced it here in New York on November 4th.
And you had, you said, pretty good sales, although nothing compared to IBM. How did you even make the public aware?
You know, there's a lot of factors that we're really lucky. For example, we mentioned carrying the portable around. Well, nobody had ever thought that when people carried these things on planes or to other offices, it was like a walking advertisement. What is that thing? Oh, show me how it works. And it caught on that way. But we also did a lot of ads. We got some PR from, you know, the fact that we grow so fast in the first year. That got us a lot of business press. And so it was a combination of things that built up.
How soon after did IBM come out with the portable computer?
Well, we completed our first year, 1983, $111 million. In the beginning of February, IBM announced their portable, and our sales stopped. So it was a real crisis for Compaq. And everybody thought we were going out of business, including some of us, but we didn't.
Well, IBM's personal computer didn't work all that well.
What
was the problem?
It was closer than most people realize. It was pretty good, but it wasn't better than ours. And probably the most significant thing is it didn't run all the software. You know, we had built our brand around running all of IBM's software. Strangely, their portable comes out, and it doesn't run some of the software. And so, you know, when you're looking at a new product trying to decide whether to switch from Compaq, it was easy to say, well, we'll just keep going with Compaq.
Do you think small companies like Compaq at the time have an advantage in a way over huge companies like IBM? The corporate culture becomes much tighter.
There's no doubt there are some advantages. You know, the culture is a key strength, but also the mobility, the ability to change direction when the market demands it. Big companies have trouble with that. But, you know, the big companies, they're like a battleship, too. You don't want to get too close to them.
Then you had different kinds of spokespersons, you and IBM.
Yes, we did. You know, that at the time, Charlie Chaplin was kind of creative, we thought. It was cute, and it got attention. But it wasn't our kind of thing. We decided on a comedian called John Cleese, who wasn't that well-known here, except to Monty Python fans. Mm-hmm. But he executed the thought, the idea of what we were trying to get over in the commercials extremely well.
Well, that allowed you to do something rather sophisticated, because John Cleese is a fairly sophisticated humorist. You takes a moment to figure out that he's being funny, and then you realize he's incredibly funny.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they also knew their core audience, tech geeks, self-avowed nerds, and, you know, certainly John Cleese and Monty Python appealed to that audience, but it ended up working for a mainstream audience as well.
And then there was even the way you brought your new products to market with live events, something that Steve Jobs and Apple would go on to perfect later.
Well, you know, it was one
you
of those things.
You couldn't copyright it, right?
No, you know, but we were fortunate to have some very creative people. And when Ken Price came up with this idea, at first I was skeptical. You know, this is going to cost money. You know, can we afford it? But when we did it, it was so impactful. I mean, we really got people come to our announcements that we never would have imagined we could get. We filled them up with the press and TV cameras, and, you know, it was great.
Yeah, and I was fortunate enough to get all the old videos of all these events, and we were able to look at the Pointer Sisters coming out at the peak of their success on a full scale model of a computer on stage, and Irene Cara and David Copperfield pulling Rod out of a box, and the list goes on. They were getting the biggest names of the era. Nowadays that's just something we all assume happens. We assume that when Apple launches whatever new phone, there's going to be either U2 or Jay-Z or somebody's going to be there. But these guys were ahead of the curve as far as that goes.
You were the first ones to do that?
We were the first ones in the computer industry. Mm-hmm. Up until then, it was a very folksy industry. Even IBM came out with a sort of a blue suit kind of announcement. And when we started doing these big entertainment things, I think people looked at it and said, I wonder if that'll work. It was a while before anybody really started doing it.
Can you discuss IBM's expectation of exclusivity when it came to computer components and the impact that Intel's decision to break that exclusivity had on the whole industry?
That, by the way, until the movie came out, was totally unknown. That was the kind of thing IBM expected. They were king. You know, they demanded things and they got them. They got an exclusive.
So you were paying
system.
A lot of royalties to them?
No, because Intel didn't follow what IBM demanded. By that time, Intel had realized that this industry was going to be much bigger than IBM, And so they didn't give it to them. The amazing thing is that they actually did give it to Compaq, because that was a big risk. That was a risk from every angle. Would IBM attack them? Would Compaq succeed, or would it fail and hurt the new chip?
And that's when we started seeing these ads with Intel inside.
Yes, they then began building their brand, even though they were deep inside the computer.
But then they became kind of the IBM of computer chips, and they had to fight new equivalents of Compaq that were trying to break their monopoly.
So when we pushed IBM out of the leadership role, we knew we couldn't take that, because it was kind of like one giant replacing another. That wouldn't be acceptable. So what we did was we created this level playing field with the industry standard, which we knew how to compete in, and we were okay with that. But what we did was we took the baton of leadership in the processor area and gave it to Intel, and for operating systems to Microsoft. So they went on to really flourish beyond that point.
At what point did IBM then decide that it was time to litigate?
Well, they were going to litigate on their patents. They had sued some companies who had copied their ROM, which we didn't, and so we never got sued on that. But they decided, everybody's violating our patents. Let's go get some money from them. And, you know, that's the way it works. So when they came to us, fortunately, they had waited about 7 years before they came to us, and they were actually violating our patents. Now, that didn't mean we didn't have to pay them. It went from having to pay them $1 billion down to maybe $130 million.
Isn't this a typical thing that happens? This is kind of like what happened with Samsung and Apple suing each other for patent violations. And it gets pretty complicated because there were all sorts of nuances involved.
Absolutely. No, it's much worse now. IBM was kind of playing nice because they were still remembering the 1956 consent decree from the Justice Department about antitrust. So they were going to follow the law, but they weren't going to be a bully about it. Today, companies like Microsoft and Apple are bullies about it. If they've got patents and you're violating them, you're gone.
Are you sorry that you didn't set up some kind of a tax haven in Ireland?
You know, I don't think that ever crossed our radar.
My guests are Rod Canyon, one of the three founders of Compaq Computers, and Jason Cohn, who's made a film about Compaq and I wouldn't say war with IBM, but
yeah, it works.
I mean, we've called it a David versus Goliath story. So,
The film is called Silicon Cowboys, and it opens this Friday at the Village East Cinema, also available on demand. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lobe. How were the lawsuits with IBM resolved?
Well, they never actually filed suit. They came to our door, you know, with a horde of lawyers. They come in, and what the typical style was, they come knock on the door and say, well, I want to see the CEO. Well, I wasn't there, or they didn't at least get to see me then. But they made demands and threatened, and, you know, we negotiated with them for quite a while and finally ended up coming to an agreement to pay them a large sum of money.
In the spring of 1987, IBM released the PS2 personal computer with an exclusive operating system. Although the idea behind this was to destroy the competition, what went wrong?
Well, what they didn't understand at that point was this industry standard that Compaq had really created and then talked about all the time. People became familiar with the idea of, if I buy one brand and switch to another, I can take all my software and all my peripherals with me. That became important. IBM never had to worry about that in mainframes or mini computers before. And so they assumed that with their brand and with an advanced enough architecture, they could pull people with them. And they just underestimated the importance of that. Now, it still took Compaq to bet the company on going a different way. So we developed a better bus that was backward compatible, and then we gave it to all of our competitors. We gave it to the industry so that we could join together and, as a force, stop IBM from taking it proprietary.
And that was the EISA?
That's it, Extended Industry Standard Architecture.
So you're giving away trade secrets because their strength in numbers.
We gave away a lot. It was the best technology available in the market. It was patented and all of that, but we gave it away, absolutely, because we knew that was the only way we even had a chance.
And I was just to say, the point of the film, that's a big moment in the film, this Gang of Nine preface conference when they got together, Microsoft and Intel and NEC and all these other companies. And, you know, we look at what the world would look like today if they hadn't stopped IBM from trying to just get this stranglehold on this industry and hold it. And one of the people in our film says, you might not say, are you a Mac or a PC? You might say, are you a Mac or an IBM if they had their way.
But there is still this kind of haggling in the industry when we see the tensions between Microsoft and Apple.
Oh, sure. You know, what happened is we started a whole new generation of computing technology when Apple came out with the iPhone. So PCs continued to grow for a while, and now it's a level or declining market. But the whole new thing is tablets and smartphones, and that's something Apple started, and Apple sort of leads and dominates.
And Compaq couldn't catch up with that?
Well, I was gone by then.
You had left.
I would love to have been involved with that, but it was sort of past my era.
What were the circumstances by which you left?
I was fired.
What had you done?
Well, there was a disagreement. It was, you know, the movie goes into it quite a bit. 1991 was a year when we had the first Gulf War. Recession followed the war. Six of our top dealers had merged into three, so there was inventory to work off. And unexpectedly, the dollar had gotten stronger. So our profits for the first time fell, and we had our first loss since we'd started.
And then there was a man named Eckhard Pfeiffer.
We had hired Eckhard. He had set up Europe, and he had been a really good manager and leader of the European organization. And then I had brought him to the U.S. to be my number two guy a year before. He had his own ideas about how fast we should move from our upscale brand to the low end of the market. And, you know, I think with Ben Rosen and some of the other people decided that they really needed to move more quickly than I was ready to move.
You were also facing challenges from other companies, Dell, and then there were the Japanese computer companies. Suddenly, this was a very, very busy market.
It was. And, you know, they quickly came out with new low-priced products the following year. But they really didn't start contributing overall for several years. It was the rebound of our brand when Apple and IBM and Dell stumbled some that really launched Compaq into the leadership role.
And then Hewlett-Packard bought Compaq. Were you surprised when they stopped using the name a few years ago?
I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed. I mean, I think maybe the hardest thing that we had accomplished was to build the best brand in the industry. So you really shouldn't, I think, give that up, but that's what happens when companies merge.
Was part of the problem. Well, they kept the Compaq name on some of the less expensive computers that they were manufacturing initially, which went against the. It was kind of opposite to what Compaq had been all about at the beginning.
It was just a gradual phase out. I mean, I think you could have expected from the beginning it was going to go away. It was just a matter of how they were going to do it and when.
Jason, in putting this film together, do you think that there are any lessons that we can learn from the story of the rise and then the demise of Compaq computers?
Yeah, well, it's an amazing story about how they did this, literally starting with three guys in a diner sketching the first portable on the back of a placemat and getting funding for that. And within a year, selling $100 million worth of computers, and then eventually within 3 years competing with one of the biggest industrial companies in the world at that point. But then, yeah, it's also a look at some of the pitfalls and what can happen when you become exactly what you were trying to rail against at times. And it was not by intention, but when your company is 10,000 people versus 100 people, there's just things that you can't control. And Rod had a great culture, but at a point, there's just things that are going to be sacrificed.
What role did Carly Fiorina play in the story?
Well, Carly came along much later, and she was at the helm.
You were gone by then.
I was way gone, but she was at the helm of HP when the merger occurred.
Mm-hmm. I will say, in doing research for the film, every time we would go just do a search trying to find archival footage or whatever, when we would type in Compaq, it was during the primary season. So every time I would type in Compaq, usually the first hit we got was about the HP Compaq merger, and Carly Fiorina's name would hit because it was during the primary season.
Yeah.
And what did you do? You didn't start another company immediately.
Well, actually, I started a consulting company. I didn't really want to get into the role of full-time CEO. I was pretty burned out after 10 years of incredible pace. And so I started a consulting company, and it grew. And about 12 years later, we sold it to IBM. It had done well. And then I've been involved in entrepreneurial startups, trying to help entrepreneurs succeed.
So you're still friends with IBM?
Oh, yeah. I respect IBM. I'm sure they respect Compaq. I haven't met anybody at IBM that hates me yet.
I'm still surprised that IBM hasn't really become a major power in the, you know, all phones and iPads and all of that, considering the fact that they just have so many things available to them.
You know, they got out of the PC market, really, at the end of the day because they couldn't make the margins they were used to in the mainframe and the software business. So they never looked, I think, going back down the chain. They wanted to go up to where there's more margin for them.
Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you.